Oh, hi, I'm Robin Hitchcock. I'm in Austin, Texas with Dennis. I'm talking into a bowl of chips in which lies a red-topped microphone.
I really, before we leave, I have to take a picture of the mic. I think the picture of us should be with the microphone and the chips for the shot for the website. When there's a body of work like yours, this album to me, there was some, not a sea change, but almost a looking backwards in some interesting sort of way. And again, I could be completely wrong here, but you know, you were just talking about the Beatles. You were talking about all the influences, all of that.
Well, they're mostly love songs, and they're pretty much all written in London, so it's a very literal title.
Ah, okay.
The only thing I had in mind was working with Paul Noble, who produced it. It was recorded in his bedroom in Clerkenwell, which is in the middle of town, almost on the edge of. If there is such a thing as old London, it's on the edge of it. Clerkenwell is on the edge of the city. It's not the industrial area or the docks, so it wasn't horribly badly bombed, but it's not that far from St. Paul's. And I've been in London most of my life, but never really acknowledged it because I'm always going somewhere else, like here or there or back again. You know, I'm like most musicians, I'm in transit. So, but I realised that if they did ever write about my life, I would be described as a Londoner. I'd be described as a London-based songwriter. You know? So I was born there in Paddington. But it's not really looking back. I think the stuff I wrote 30 years ago was probably more nostalgic or more elegiac or more wistful. I have a certain variety of tricks. You know, I have a fairly limited palette, and the windscreen wiper of my recorded performance goes from very quiet and on my own to rather more orchestrated and with other people. This one sounds orchestrated and with other people, but actually it has no real drums on it. Everything is played by either Paul and myself. Apart from the cello played by Jenny Adjaian, and then there's the three vocalists, Jen Macro and Lucy Parnell and Annalisa Frykdal from Norway. And Annalisa was the only person who wasn't actually there while it was recorded. She sent her voice down the phone. So the only concept really was to record the songs effectively without using a recording studio and a band and going for takes. So the songs were all built up rhythmically, built up from a rhythm. I'd play the song and Paul would figure out roughly what tempo it was and what beat. We'd find a beat we liked and then we'd build it up from that, which is how records have been made commercially for probably like 35 years, but this is the first time I've actually done it. So it's a kind of me very, very belatedly probably entering the 80s in terms of production. I'm a 60s musician. I'm the last to hatch out, and I've always proclaimed that fact. You know, my shtick and my raison d'etre is as the last 60s artist to hatch out, rather than being someone from the 80s who harks back to the 60s. I don't hark back to them. I just that's where I'm from. But I'm also not trying to recreate the 60s. I don't believe that the rainbow is, you know, stretches from Berkeley across to Marin County. I don't smoke pot. I love visiting the Hate as a tourist, and I have nostalgia about nostalgia when it comes to San Francisco, but I have no illusions that it's actually 1967, and I have no desire to turn the clock back. I just think that's when the matrix of pop, where pop became rock, and it's now in all the history books. We've just been talking about it this morning on the Beatles panel. That's the period that if that's the flower bed, I'm one of the things that grows out of it. And this is my latest variation on that theme. All my records have been on that theme, really.
When you said you know you're catching up, and you're doing it the way that it would have been done in the 80s, but think of all these modern bands who do hatch their records these days due to the tools that are available, you know, in their bedroom, you know, in their on their iPads and iPods and all of that.
Yeah, that's the big difference from in the 80s. If you recorded at home, you could record on, you know, 4-track cassette.
Right.
And you made, I made demos back then on 4-track cassette, which I really like, like the sound of. But I don't think, you know, it's not the same now. As you say, the technology has made it available. You can have Abbey Road in your bedroom. So, whereas, you know, in the 80s, or even by the late 70s, people were working to click tracks and then building the music up around it. But they had to do that in recording studios. We just figured that there wasn't a good mid-budget recording studio easily available to us. And, you know, I wasn't in a position to go out and hire Abbey Road 3 or something like that, which right. I might do one day if I wanted to splash out. But, you know, this seemed like a much more economical way of working, because we also actually spent about 8 months. Paul spent about 8 months putting it together.
Mixing it and...
No, just between like January and... No, probably more. January and October, actually. Recording it and fine-tuning it, you know, just a little bit here and there. So it sprawled over quite a big length of time, which if you'd been paying for studio costs would have been a lot.
So the work that went into the record most certainly shows, because it's still a very lush record, you know.
Some of my stuff was lo-fi, if only because it was done cheaply or done
right.
on, you know...
But you don't set out to make your vocals sound, you know, like so many bands today.
No, I never went for distorted vocals.
Yeah.
No, I'm very un-90s. I never went into that.
And even today, there are bands that go to Detroit, you know, to two or three
studios. To get their voices distorted.
To work really hard to see how deep the voice can be in the fuzz. And I'm not putting it down. It's certainly a style, but like you said, the garage era is kind of, you know, It's come and gone to a certain extent. So
I couldn't see the point, but I think it's to do with texture, or it may even to do with like where you hear the music or under what influence you are when you listen to it. You know, it's there's kind of stuff that if you adjusted your mental dial might sound great. You know, just generally sort of distorted or overdriven, or just with an unusual, like a sort of descended from dub, really, where you just push up things you wouldn't expect to have. I know what, we'll push up the bass drum and then we'll have a little keyboard noodling and we'll drive the guitar into deep fuzz and we'll have someone singing on one channel through what sounds like a loud hailer, a megaphone, you know. And it's a tech, you can produce textures that haven't been heard before, I suppose, but I'm pretty old-fashioned or traditional. I like to get the song over as clearly and coherently as possible, so you can hear all the words, you can hear the tune, the vocals as in tune as possible, so are the harmonies, you know, basically Beatle music.
You grew up with a father who was a novelist. So from moment one, writing was in, I mean, I write for a living too, writing was in your blood, you know, and you also did grow up, like you said, last of the 60s, in that era where songs were songs.
Well, songs were songs. Actually, my dad was an engineer, a sort of electrical engineer, a communications engineer.
Right.
And he was involved in the early Mercury satellites and cables and stuff like that. And then he became a cartoonist and then a painter. And then he became a novelist. He tried out different things. He never tried music, which is perhaps why I went into music. But I suppose by the later part of the 60s, for a variety of well-documented reasons, you could kind of put anything you wanted into a song. Like that, for instance.
That would be a good one.
And you, we were just talking about this in the seminar on the Beatles, and I think that that's kind of still true musically in terms of sounds and experiment, maybe, but in terms of lyrics, songs seem, I don't know, rock feels very tame now. It feels like it knows its limitations. It's a beast that knows the size of its own cage, you know. It's really become part, it's just part of the economy. And you know, arguably pop always celebrated life under capitalism back in the days of the Beach Boys and Chuck Berry, you know, and things haven't really changed. It's just got a bit more brutal. But and bland, but it seems as though pop kind of knows it. Like I said, it knows its place. It you know, it knows where the concession stands are and where the restrooms are and which row you're sitting in, and it knows when the curfew is, and it knows it's not going to change the government. It's not even going to change. It's done its work in sort of political terms in a way. It's not a driving force behind the Occupy movements or anything like that. Although a lot of us are on the left and are generally humane and of a liberal inclination. So, you know, but it's not a. If you want to be a bad boy or girl of rock now, all you have to do is pull out a cigarette. It has the same effect as producing a hypodermic did 35 years ago. You don't mean to say you smoke? Oh my God! You know, if you want to do a photo session for Rolling Stone with a cigarette, they know you're bad. You know, that's all you have to do, and all you're doing is just, you know, toting a corporate emblem. So it's kind of. Doesn't mean to say that the music's dead or it's over or it's bad. It's just that it's had its, you know, it's had its high water mark. It's peaked in terms of innovation and influence. Probably nothing will equal the acceleration that happened in music and in society between 1964 and 1970. I kept coming back to the Beatles again. You know. I don't think you can transmit wisdom, really. You can't transmit experience, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the race would just get wiser and wiser, but it doesn't. It just gets more and more technologically lethal. You know, there's all the sort of cliches and truisms, you know, be true to yourself, do what you comes most naturally to you, write about what you know, be who you are, all that stuff, the stuff about being genuine. But of course, some people's genuineness is artifice. It's actually, some people are really good at being artificial, and what comes naturally to them is layers of fakery. And you know, not everyone has a soul to bear. You know, some people, maybe you find out about them from what they don't say rather than what they do say. I would just say, if you want to produce music that people will love, you have to love music. If you love music enough, it will probably wind up writing itself. You can put your name on it and it goes from there, but you really have to, it has to matter to you. You know, I don't think you can sort of luck into things or say, I mean, I don't know, supposedly Paul McCartney was actually going on a supermarket management training course while the Beatles were in Hamburg, or somebody,
can you imagine?
You know, in between. Well, I can, because he was the realist of the group, you know, and he thought, well, if this may not work out and I've got a few A levels, I could get a decent job as a supermarket manager, and that might lead him somewhere. You know, he's definitely a reasonably astute businessman. I think, I'm sure that his love really was of music, and I don't think it's like it made no odds to him whether he was a supermarket manager or a Beatle. You know, it's like if something's magnetized, if you magnetize this fork, listeners. Here's the sound of a fork pretending to magnetize a spoon. It will drag that this fork will drag that spoon along. I know a restaurant in Seattle where they have magnetic cutlery so that the cutlery doesn't get thrown in the trash. So, and you know, if you want to magnetize, you have to be magnetized. And I think it's a sort of weird mixture of surrender and compulsion. Then people will start to follow you because you're following something and you're transmitting that. If people like me at all, it's because I'm a quite powerful transmitter, because when I'm beaming in on something, I pull things in with me. But that's nothing to do, you know, whether I'm any good or not. All it means is that I'm under some sort of compulsion. And so you have to make yourself open to that compulsion. Like I said, love music, and you will produce music that you love.